I've been a little bit everywhere in my mind lately. That's partly because so much is happening at once, and partly because I've been shaping a much larger project, one that I'll start talking about soon. What follows is a kind of preface to that work, and also an article that was recently published in the Spectre Journal titled "Rethinking the Syrian Revolution: How the Left Misread Syria." There will be a link to it in the show notes, and perhaps I'll read it in a future episode. If you've followed my writing or this podcast, you'll know this isn't a sudden change in direction. It's really the next logical step in a long attempt to understand. And what do I mean by understand? Well, when I first began making videos and podcasts, as many of you know, I planned on focusing on the far right in the United States, and I still do so from time to time. But as I worked, I realized there were already excellent researchers and journalists covering a lot of the things that I was interested in. Something that did raise questions, though, made me ask what's going on here, was when I was looking sideways within spaces calling themselves left or anti-imperialist. I started seeing statements that were factually wrong, just objectively incorrect, or historically distorted, and I wanted to know why. My background is in history. I spent years working in archives, including time with the Ukrainian American Historical Society, and that was around the time of the Orange Revolution. That experience taught me how narratives are built, how propaganda circulates within that topic, and how easily selective memory becomes politics. I should also say that it was around this time that I had my second child and I stopped adjunct teaching when I started thinking of all these different things. And so that kind of left a hole. And that's where these videos came from, really, was that extra time that I had. Anyway, when I saw misinformation traveling across social media, I recognized familiar patterns. What stood out to me was how these patterns blurred the boundaries between left and right. Ideas that I associated with reactionary movements were reappearing in spaces that claimed to speak for the left. At first, I tried to counter falsehoods directly, as many of you know if you've seen my earlier work, posting evidence, arguing facts, confronting contradictions, even applying some of the fallacious way of framing things back upon the organizations and people perpetuating those. But over time, I grew less interested in debating point by point and more concerned with the why. Why people were drawn into these distortions, why they were being repeated by voices that sometimes should know better, and what those repetitions were doing to our shared sense of reality, or maybe another way of saying that, solidarity. And that shift changed my focus on many things. I had started a book, and it'll most likely be self-published, but it might be published. And I put that on hold because the way that I was approaching things analytically, historically, was not answering the questions that I was beginning to ask, the whys. So it began as a historical correction. This is true, this is false, but evolved into something more reflective, a study of how ideas shape us and how ideology becomes identity in some cases. I stopped thinking only about misinformation as an external problem and started asking what it revealed about us internally. How had these frameworks molded the left itself, and how had they even shaped me? In short, I transitioned from historical research methods to more philosophical and even some psychological questions. At some point, I realized that the question wasn't only about misinformation or disinformation, but about understanding where it came from, why it's here, and how it's impacting us. Maybe another way of saying that is I started asking about meaning. There's a parrallel here to something that Noam Chomsky wrote early in his career, an essay called The Responsibility of Intellectuals. It remains valuable, but in my humble opinion, it's somewhat incomplete Chomsky focused on the duty to expose lies of power, which is an essential task, but he left out another responsibility. And that responsibility is examining the power within our own movements and our own narratives, and even within ourselves. And this brings us to self-critique. Self-critique isn't the whole of political ethics, but it's a necessary part of it. And I've seen what happens when that reflection disappears. I wrote about 1990s subcultures that I was socialized in, the mix of music, anarchism, and moral urgency that shaped my early politics. And there's a Substack article about that. While revisiting that period, I reached out to Rob Miller. He was a former bassist and singer of Amoebics who later embraced Holocaust denial and destroyed his career, credibility, and hurt many people around him. During our exchange, he told me, "It seems like you're searching for something." And, you know, he wasn't wrong about that. He misread the direction. I believe he thought that he was reeling me into his nonsense. But I was trying to understand how someone like him could end up defending the indefensible. And I even reflected a bit on myself and seeing if there had been any moral, ethical blind spots in my past. And, you know, that conversation has stayed with me. It clarified why I keep returning to the topic, because in many ways, it gets back to the topic of meaning. And of course, meaning is interpreted differently by people. And with all the misinformation and disinformation and corrections that I focused on earlier, it really began to focus on perhaps a collapse of meaning. And what that collapse of meaning is, just not theoretically, right? It's personal, it's cultural, it's moral. Understanding how people cross that line requires looking at ourselves, not only at caricatures or our opponents or memes. All this unfolds while the world is burning, of course. There are urgent crises everywhere. Gaza under siege, authoritarian tightening in the United States, ICE and National Guard being deployed at home, millions displaced across borders. I've written about these in other contexts, about Gaza's history, about domestic militarization, such as the new politics. But this piece asks a different question. How can movements confront external power if they refuse to examine their own internal questions or failures? How can we speak about justice while treating critique specifically as betrayal? That's why, in defense of leftist self-critique, I ask and try to answer some of these questions. It's short because it's meant to stand as a statement of principle. It's not an exhaustive argument. It marks a turning point from reaction towards reconstruction, from simply identifying falsehoods to asking what a more coherent, self-aware politics might look like. And, you know, this isn't easy. It's meant stepping back from social media, reducing output, and spending more time listening to activists, to exiles, to refugee voices, to people building new forms of solidarity outside of the frameworks that dominate Western debate or visibility on social media. And many of them live in the realities others just theorize about. Their insights have greatly shaped what's coming next. What I learned through these years now of research and conversation is that critique, when done with care, is not division. It's actually a form of devotion. It's what keeps a movement from becoming stale, from becoming hardened and inflexible, dogmatic. So this is where I'm beginning again, with a short piece that recenters responsibility, humility, and truth as foundations for solidarity, which is really the key that I've now been focused on. The whys still exist, and those questions still exist, but those only go so far. You know, there has to be some type of solution or some type of conclusion to why. And for me, it's circled around the concept of solidarity and what that is. The book that I'm currently working on, I'm over halfway done, we'll explore these themes in much greater detail about how propaganda intersects with philosophy, how denialism seeps through ideological borders, how meaning collapses and can be rebuilt. But the goal in that reconstruction or rebuilding or new propositions is always focused on solidarity. And this article is the doorway into that type of conversation. It's also a confession of sorts. I've spent a long time reacting to what others say and not enough time articulating what could replace it. From here, the goal is not only to expose errors, but to try and help create some new ideas. So before we move into those wider discussions in the future, I wanted to share the seed of it. The question that runs beneath every argument and every story that I've been involved with. And that's, what does solidarity mean? And what do we do when the truth hurts? How do we react to that? Because those two things are interrelated. So here then is the beginning in the defense of leftist self-critique. Every movement begins with conviction, but within reflection, it can turn into dogma. That dogma, however generalized or unclear, is defended in the name of moral clarity. While it provides the illusion of being crystal clear, it can also harden like a crystal, crushing the guiding principles that first gave it shape. What remains is not thought, but protection from scrutiny. A glance at social media threads or comment sections illustrates this. It is not only opponents who argue this way, as these habits also appear within the same political wing. A growing industry profits from this pattern. Arguments and reactions multiply, producing little more than subscription fees for platforms like Patreon or Substack. The pattern is not limited to the internet. It also shapes discussion within many activists and political groups. It surfaces when people try to critique those they otherwise support. This is understandable and comes from a protective instinct. On the left, there's a sense that, given the limited institutional power, unity must take the place of criticism. People are also inclined to defend their choices and identities. When they tie their sense of self to a movement or belief, any challenge can feel like a personal attack. The result is a politics driven more by a psychology of protectiveness than by the desire to understand. When that protectiveness turns dogmatic, the need for unity becomes more than an emotional reflex. It shapes how movements organize power. Foucault showed how systems of control endure not by force, but by teaching people to police themselves. In Discipline and Punish, Foucault examined how surveillance teaches people to regulate themselves. When loyalty replaces critique, political movements start to reflect the very structures of control they set out to challenge. This does not happen through coercion, but through habits of self-restraint, the pull of the group, and the quiet fear of being seen as unfaithful to the cause. At its worst, the outcome is not only empty, but harmful. As George Orwell warned in Politics and the English Language, vague and sloganized language does not clarify thought, but corrupts it. Quote, if thought corrupts language, language also corrupts thought. When political speech depends on approval, it ceases to describe reality and serves only to reinforce accepted thought. What begins as a moral conviction hardens into dogma, and words meant to liberate end up justifying the very practices they once sought to resist. Against this false clarity stands another kind of clarity, one born of self-critique. It resists the deterioration of thought, where words are emptied of meaning and used to avoid what is real. To choose this clarity is to choose honesty over comfort, and honesty becomes the beginning of solidarity. There are and will always be people you disagree with who nonetheless make valid points. To recognize this is not a weakness, but a strength. It's how movements and people grow. By refusing to treat disagreement as disqualification, and instead testing which ideas endure. Self-critique is the habit that lets us take what is useful and leave what is not, without reducing people to a single stance or mistake. When thought leaders with large platforms who otherwise get most things right offer flawed or misleading analysis, there's a strong pressure to remain silent. It can feel safer to stay in our lane. After all, who are we to challenge them? And why take aim at the few voices who have managed to break into the wider public conversation? In my experience, when these criticisms are raised, the familiar defense is that such thinkers are not specialists, and their generalization should be forgiven for the sake of the greater argument. Others argue that too much nuance only creates confusion, and that broader claims are what bring people together. It is true that no single person holds all the answers, but this reply deflects from the original point. When distinctions are abandoned too fully, clarity is not gained but lost. Nuance is not pedantry, and we expect it from those that we oppose. It is what keeps weak analysis from being mistaken for truth. This is especially dangerous when it comes from those with the largest of platforms. Rigor is how we test whether claims that rally people are grounded in fact and in solidarity with those directly affected. Without that discipline, politics devolves into noise, and the loudest voices are mistaken for the truest ones. The task of anyone who claims to think seriously about politics is to speak up when something is wrong, even when it is uncomfortable to do so. That responsibility does not stop with governments or with those in power. It extends to our movements, to our theories, and to ourselves. Self-criticism is not betrayal. It is the ground on which real solidarity stands. Some believe that drawing fine distinctions is unnecessary. Even partial or loosely formed critiques from popular figures are often treated as valuable simply because they raise awareness. As noted earlier, there is truth in these objections. Organizers know that a strike or protest cannot depend on every participant mastering theory. Sometimes a slogan like fight the boss or end the war is enough to act. Movements need that kind of clarity in the street. However, when we think, write, and create, the opposite of clarity is not pragmatism, but dogmatism. This dogmatism blocks new ideas, stifles invention, and produces poor analysis. Rosa Luxemburg cautioned against this, noting that, quote, "The errors committed by a truly revolutionary movement are infinitely more fruitful than the infallibility of the cleverest central committee." She also reminded readers that freedom only for supporters of the government, only for of the members of one party, however numerous they may be, is no freedom at all. True freedom and revolutionary vitality depend on allowing dissent. Errors born of honest struggle are far healthier than enforced correctness. When movements silence internal criticism, they stop being revolutionary and start mirroring the authoritarian systems that they oppose. Dogmatism also reveals a deeper problem in the West. When movements refuse to hear contradictory voices, they sometimes silence those who live inside the conflicts they claim to understand. This defensive narrative at the expense of global voices repeats similar exclusions enforced by empire. It produces a hierarchy of knowledge in which many Western thinkers speak about the oppressed rather than with them. Edward Said warned of this impulse, quote, "There's always the temptation to identify oneself with power and to assume the voice of authority rather than to represent those who have no voice." The exclusion of those perspectives has nothing to do with solidarity, but it instead is a subtle form of neocolonial thought, where concern for justice becomes another exercise in control. Said also reminded us that, quote, "The task of the intellectual is to raise embarrassing questions, to confront orthodoxy and dogma rather than to produce them." The task for those who claim to work for justice is to face their own illusions and to identify all sources of power, not only those named in their ideology. In the theory of communicative action, Hirgen and Habermas argue that democracy depends on the testing of claims in public through open discussion rather than persuasion or coercion. When language bends to power or fear, it stops serving understanding and begins serving control. Without the ability to question, conversations slide into manipulation and loses its democratic meaning. This breakdown of communicative action happens when dialogue no longer aims at mutual understanding, but at compliance. In that space, persuasion replaces understanding, and the strategies of politics push aside the pursuit of honest discussion. The discipline of self-critique does not stop at the level of movements or intellectuals. It begins with us. To admit when we are wrong and to hear correction without defensiveness is the everyday practice of self-critique. If we cannot model it with our friends, we will not build it in politics. The spaces where disagreement is welcomed are the spaces where trust deepens. Critiquing one's own movement, tradition, or framework is a deeper form of commitment. Genuine solidarity requires more than uncritical loyalty. To critique is not to reject, but to care. It is to believe that what we are part of is capable of becoming better. Every movement risks moral complacency when it stops asking questions. Blind allegiance does not protect what we value. It weakens it from within. Real devotion, whether to an idea, a cause, or a collective, means wanting it to live up to its own principles and responsibilities. Self-critique also protects movements from manipulation. When people are taught that questioning their leaders or narratives is betrayal, they become easy to control. History shows this clearly. The movements that endure are those that build mechanisms for internal correction. The ones that suppress dissent adopt the traits of what they claim to oppose. As Herbert Marcuse wrote in Eros and Civilization, societies built on domination shape the people within them. Quote, the economic and political incorporation of individuals into the hierarchical system of labor, he explained, is accompanied by an instinctual process in which the human objects of domination reproduce their own repression. Liberation is not found in new rulers, but in loosening ourselves from the habits of obedience that old systems left behind. In this sense, self-critique serves a vital function, and fulfilling that function is part of our responsibility. The culture we live in pushes against critique. Algorithms reward what is simple and viral. The flourishing populist rhetoric of today thrives on broad strokes and easy slogans. The more a phrase can be stripped of context, the faster it spreads. Social media silences nuance, amplifies caricature, and buries dissent. Self-critique resists this logic. It slows the rush to simplification and forces detail back into conversation. It demands that ideas survive questioning rather than ride a trending wave of reaction. In that sense, it is not only a practice of thought, but an act of rebellion against the technology that teaches us to value and reproduce its own patterns. Alternative media may appear to offer an escape from this pattern, but it also operates within its own propaganda filters. What is marketed as dissent often turns into yet another version of groupthink, disguised as rebellion. Raising such points can result in punishment within that technology through tactics such as loss of visibility or prevention of growth. Questioning prevailing sentiments can also lead to being pushed aside in daily life, once algorithmic habits are internalized, showing how technology shapes both thought and behavior. Self-critique is rarely easy because it challenges the comfort of certainty. However, that discomfort is what allows for growth. Without it, movements stiffen into dogma or slide into what they set out to challenge. To critique is to take people seriously, to treat them as well as their audience as equals, capable of argument rather than as followers, who must be shielded from complexity. Human nature also pushes us there. People ask questions, and when they are silenced, they seek answers elsewhere. If our politics cannot survive critique, they cannot survive reality. To practice self-critique is not a betrayal, but a form of solidarity. It is rebellion against dogma, algorithmic reduction, and intellectual hegemony. It is the refusal to let caricature replace thought. To critique with honesty is also to practice care. It's a way of saying we value one another enough to argue openly, to risk discomfort, rather than settle for empty reassurance. This is the ground on which real solidarity stands. In a world that rewards noise, self-criticism is how we stay human together. So that's the piece. It's short, but it carries weight for me. And it does so because it marks a shift from trying to analyze or report to asking what the arguments involved mean in the first place. For a long time, I thought the best way to counter distortions was to present evidence, show contradictions, correct the record, engage in historical research, essentially, and analysis. But that's only half of the work. Facts alone don't change people. That's why this project has changed shape so many times. It started as a map of misinformation and became a study of how stories themselves become ideological instruments. Somewhere along the way, I stopped asking, why is this narrative being misrepresented, or who benefits from this narrative, and started asking, what need does that narrative fill? When I wrote In Defense of Leftist Self-Critique, I wanted to name that turning point. What I'm preparing next builds on this, connecting what happens in these echo chambers to a larger philosophical and historical analysis. It asks how propaganda seeps through moral language, how denialism becomes a form of belonging in some cases, and what it takes to rebuild solidarity after meaning has collapsed. This is the first step in that direction, a small one, but necessary. So if you've read the article or listened to this, thank you. Thanks for being part of this process. I don't take it lightly. Thank you again. So well, you can lock your dog.